In this episode of Interchain FM, we peer into the long-term economic outlook of the world as it relates to cryptocurrency. Andreas Antonopoulos joins us to cover the future of the industry amidst an ongoing pandemic. What wallets can do now in order to monetize and better enable user adoption of the coins that they support? What's in store for the startups in the industry as venture capital dries up and natural selection takes hold? And how an Interchain future will evolve as standards across protocols mature. On this episode of Interchain FM, we're here with Andreas Antonopoulos. Welcome.
It's a pleasure to be on the show. How are you?
Very good. Thanks for coming on the show. It's very exciting. I've been listening to you for the past several years when I got into Bitcoin. So this is very exciting for you to come on.
Oh, thank you so much. It's really a pleasure.
Given the current situation that we are in with the quarantines and coronavirus and everything, and Bitcoin sort of not doing what a lot of people were expecting it to do, just curious what your thoughts about that are.
For me, it is doing what I expected it to do. From my perspective, the way Bitcoin is treated has a lot to do about context and the perspective of the people interacting with it. So at any moment in time, there are some people who are using Bitcoin as a medium of exchange, some people who are using it as a store of value, some people who are using it as a speculative asset. And all of these people are engaging with Bitcoin from their perspective, in their context, from the basis of what they need in their lives at that moment, whether that's a speculator who's trying to add some spice to their portfolio and treating it as a highly speculative, volatile, risk-on asset, or someone who's in a country that's dealing with very poor currency, very big currency challenges, currency controls, authoritarian government, who's treating it as a way to protect their assets or the future of their family, to people who are using it for remittances or trade or import-export businesses or whatever other trade activity they might have. At any moment in time, all of these different things are in constant competition. And a couple of months ago, I kept getting asked by people, do you think if we have an economic crisis, it's going to be good for Bitcoin and other cryptos? I was struck by that question because it seems that a lot of people wanted Bitcoin to succeed by wishing for a catastrophe to befall the rest of the economy, which I thought was a very strange and also kind of antisocial attitude. 2 months ago, I predicted that, listen, if there is an economic recession, the first thing that's going to happen is many of the people who are treating this as a speculative investment are going to dump it really quick in order to shore up their cash positions, as they're going to do with any asset that they feel has a higher degree of risk or volatility. And they're going to keep doing that until they have their majority of their positions in cash and have gotten rid of all risk on assets. And that effect is going to be felt long before we feel the effect of people trying to battle inflation or currency controls or bank bailouts and things like that by using it as a store of value. That's exactly what happened. So Bitcoin's doing exactly what I thought it would do. The other trend, which is that when it becomes difficult to get access to cash, when it becomes difficult to transmit money across borders, when cash starts exhibiting inflation, as do other assets and commodities, then I think we're going to see more of the other story of Bitcoin playing out. And those forces are going to ebb and flow. To me, Bitcoin proving itself happens every 10 minutes on average when it fails to stop working. And the ability of a system like this to fail to stop working, to fail to die, to refuse to die for 10 years continuously and every 10 minutes go, hey, still here. That is, to me, success.
I want to pick up on one aspect of your answer there that you heard, and I've heard this too, many people with a sort of twisted wish for a financial crisis to prove the utility or prove their contrarian position or investment in Bitcoin. And honestly, as someone who hopes that some of these networks will provide an alternative to some of the functions of a modern state, to me, this COVID-19 humanitarian crisis, frankly, is proof that they haven't succeeded yet, that we have a lot more work to do that many of the functions of government are not at all being provided by decentralized ledgers. And in order to get there, we need to think long and hard about the right kinds of problems we need to be solving. Do you think that Bitcoin and Ethereum and their descendants will be able to play roles, say, if a worldwide pandemic happens in a decade? Will they be more useful than they are today? And if so, how?
I think they're already providing a role. It's just that that role is fairly limited in its breadth and only available to people who currently have the technical expertise to operate this fairly difficult to use technology, which is still not mature enough to be easy to use. I'm currently using Bitcoin to protect myself against some of the side effects of this pandemic. I know hundreds of thousands of people are, not billions, not millions, but certainly hundreds of thousands of people, potentially millions. From one perspective, the idea that this is not a successful system if it can't save everyone now, I think is a flawed way of looking at it. I think if it is a better system than the alternatives, then it can serve some people today. The other thing I think is, it seems like everybody's in a rush to call this. Like, oh yeah, there we go. Bitcoin's being tested. COVID happened. Bitcoin didn't moon. Game over. It's almost like Biden's president, moving on. Nothing to see here. Stop voting, everyone. That kind of betrays a lack of perspective, because at this moment in time, we have barely even seen the beginning of the crisis in, well, at least in the United States, but I think even more worldwide. We're barely seeing the tip of the iceberg in the crisis, let alone the much more long-term impact that this crisis will have on society as a whole. If you accept the fact that we're not going back to normal because the new normal will not be like the old normal, that this is likely to last for months, if not years, and that it's going to deeply affect many societies around that, that's my perspective. We have barely, like most people in America, have been shut in at home, and that's not even the majority, for 2 weeks. That's it. Maybe 1 week in most places. It's going to take a while for all of this to sink in. And a lot of people have become extremely adept at practicing this incredible degree of denial where they attempt to ignore what's happening and pretend it's going to go away quickly. So from that perspective, I think this hasn't even yet started. The impact of COVID has barely started across the world. Most people do not appreciate the degree of crisis until it's happening to someone they know or someone who looks like them. So a lot of people are very capable of achieving enormous degrees of denial right now. And that's just the COVID crisis. The impact of $4 trillion in stimulus, the massive income inequality that this is going to create, the massive wealth transfer, and the fragility of the US dollar and all other currencies that are coming out of this will take years to play out. I'm not ready to call this test over. I think the test has barely begun. And I think this is such a big and transformational change. It's a generational change. It will affect society's behavior. It will affect governance and corporations. It's going to affect governments. It's going to affect central banks to degrees we can't even imagine yet. And at this point, decades can happen in the next 6 weeks. So I'm not ready to call this competition over.
I'm aligned with that vision that you're seeing. And so if it is the case that wealth transfer is going to occur over a time span of years, and then by the end of the recession, it'll be our grandparents or parents that realize that their retirement savings is massively reduced in value, then at that point, that demographic is going to start realizing that they need an alternative, and perhaps they're going to view Bitcoin as an alternative solution. Our listeners are largely builders in the space. What would you tell them to kind of start preparing now for that time when grandparents are going to start funneling into cryptocurrency, perhaps? What should they be doing now to make that transition easier for all of those millions of people who are going to have lost livelihoods and retirement funds?
I honestly don't know if that's even possible. I think many technologies like this have a generational gap whereby they're so alien and disruptive to the previous generation that it's only the next generation that really adopts it and takes it to heart. Most of the grandparents I know are having a really hard time even adopting basic internet technologies and turning off the TV and doing some online research to learn more about what's happening. So I very much doubt that. I think it's very difficult to adapt in that way to this kind of radical change. Humans are not very good at change. I mean, if you want some practical advice, I can give you some practical advice now. Make the fonts bigger. For the love of God, make the fonts bigger. I'm now in my late 40s. I went from not wearing glasses ever in the last 5 years, significant deterioration of my reading eyesight. So I'm beginning to get really frustrated with applications that have tiny fonts that I either have to hold the phone 3 meters away from me or wear glasses all the time. So make bigger fonts. But more seriously, a lot of this technology is currently at the stage where many of the internal complexity is shown directly to users. And there hasn't been enough effort and investment in product and user interface and user experience design to hide and abstract away some of that complexity so it becomes easier. I remember the same path occurring with the internet, you know, from the very early days until you had the kind of ease of use that allowed my dad to become a fairly prolific internet user. But we haven't yet seen that. We're still currently in the, I don't know, first, second generation of mobile wallets and user interfaces for this technology. It's still very hard to use. And I don't think there's enough emphasis being put on product design, user interface, user experience. And I think a lot of the front end, if you like, of this technology, which is the wallet, or just like the browser for the web, the wallet is the front end. It's the primary interface through which most people experience cryptocurrency. That whole industry has not yet figured out how to properly monetize products over the long term. They make great, fun, beautiful wallets and then fail to monetize them and run into a situation where the technology starts moving ahead and the wallets just fall behind. They're not able to adapt to the new features, the new address formats, the new whatever. They gradually fall further and further behind in maintenance until they're no longer a great wallet, and then you choose another one. I've now probably gone through 24 different mobile wallets over the past 7 years, watching that process happen again and again. So I think one of the big problems we have in our industry is having good monetization and business models for wallets so that they can sustain the degree of maintenance and development to keep up with the features of the protocol and the investment needed in product design and user experience to make it very, very easy and hide the complexity. It's going to take a really big overhaul of that part of the industry to get us to that level where it's easy to use.
Speaking of monetizing wallets, have you checked out Argent Wallet? So I actually haven't used that wallet yet, but it was brought to my attention. And apparently what they do is they're kind of like a broker for all of the cryptocurrencies that it supports. And yeah. It takes like a fee for the transactions that you make, and particularly DeFi transactions. So I think we're starting to see wallets, if this takes off, trend towards kind of being the mobile interface for people to use as a personal finance interface to all of their DeFi investment vehicles.
Absolutely. I mean, I would guess wallets like Argent, I would probably categorize as kind of second or third generation wallets. And we're beginning to see that. Similar things are happening in Bitcoin with Lightning wallets that are getting to be fairly advanced and well-designed. And it's really about cracking this monetization issue, because if you don't have the funding, the continuous and stable funding to ensure that you can keep up with maintenance and features, then, you know, launching software is not the end of a project. It's the very beginning of a project. When you launch the software, then all your headaches become real, right? right? Now you have users, which is the worst thing that can happen to software. Honestly, a lot of business people don't understand kind of the software lifecycle and how hard it is to keep up, especially when you have a rapidly developing technology like this. And the perfect example is Ethereum. The number of changes to go from a simple Ethereum wallet to an Ethereum wallet that supports the most simple type of tokens, which took almost a year and a half until you had like broad ERC-20 support that was robust across most wallets, to then five other different standards for tokens, fungible, non-fungible, the newer ones, ERC-1155, et cetera, to then this whole jungle of DeFi ecosystem. There is no stopping that. One of the problems that wallet makers face is that all of that change is coming from outside their companies. They can't control the pace. They can't decide how to prioritize product features because they don't decide. Their users decide what they need right now. It's a very difficult space to work in, just like internet browsers, web browsers, were a very, very challenging space. And for the first 15 years, the battle in browsers until they got to the point where they really, really became suitable for users and easy to use and robust and featureful and well monetized, it took a good 15 years. In fact, you know, we're still seeing problems with monetization of Firefox, Mozilla, you know, or Opera and other non-dominant browsers. Same thing is going to happen, I think, in the crypto space. And it really requires some very, very good entrepreneurs and some very, very good technical and design teams to make these products. I think all of the pace of development in the entire crypto ecosystem is bottlenecked through wallets. If a feature doesn't exist in the wallet, it doesn't exist. Doesn't matter if you wrote it into the protocol. Doesn't matter if you built a very great smart contract. If a user can't use it in a simple, easy way with a single click, the feature doesn't exist. So no matter how fast you're moving or how many great products you're building, until a wallet designer designs an interface for it, you're stuck. And we're seeing that it's especially painful in Bitcoin, but it's also painful in Ethereum and other blockchains.
Given where we are in cryptocurrency development, I want to ask the question to kind of just like get our pulse back on the timeline, right? Where is blockchain technology relative to where the internet was before the internet became mature enough for users to use?
I would say we're probably around the mid-90s from my perspective. So we're beginning to see, after the initial explosion of the ecosystem and the first wave of consolidation, I think we're probably around 95, 96 in terms of internet years. That's what it feels like to me compared to how the internet felt like to me then. By that point, I'd already been using the internet for 7 or 8 years. It was still a very obscure place that only a few experts were on. The user interfaces were still very clunky, et cetera. I don't think we've had kind of the next big 3 or 4 waves of mainstreaming and familiarization that happened with the internet. I don't think those have happened yet.
I watched your talk about going from protocols to standardization of protocols.
The one I did at Blockstack.
Yeah.
Ah, very good.
I was hoping you could expound about that, because after listening to that and reading the CoinDesk article about your vision of an interchain future, I wanted to get a sense of like what the realized vision of that is, especially because we've been working on Cosmos for a while and, you know, we have like our variation of that vision. Just wondering if there's any alignment there, you know, if we're going to end up in the same end state.
Yeah, well, of course, I mean, it's very easy to look at a system that has evolved like that in retrospect and kind of mark the important milestones and roadmaps. And it's very difficult when you're in it to see how it's playing out. I speak from the experience I've had with similar technologies and the evolution of protocols in my kind of 25-year career on the internet. I would say that what we generally see with technologies like this is a series of cycles where you have at first a period of very, very rapid experimentation that leads to very rapid fragmentation, where everybody explores a different path or a different niche and everybody tries to reinvent and redo some of the protocols and put their own little twist on them. And you end up with a mess, right? A mess of fragmented, non-interoperable, non-interchangeable technologies that don't work with each other and that are all competing for the same very narrow space. We saw that with internet protocols, internet-related protocols or pre-internet protocols, with the battles over layer two technology, which I think are most common to the battles over blockchains today. The era of Ethernet battling Token Ring and various other proprietary networking technologies like NetWare that were battling out for layer two technologies. And at the time, there was no interoperable mechanism. And gradually, what we saw was a variety of layer three protocols that emerged to bridge the gap. And for the most part, those started off as simple single gateway nodes, meaning that you had a network in an office that was on one standard, let's say Token Ring, and you had a network in an office that was on another standard, let's say Novell NetWare. And then you put a computer in between that had both of the different interfaces, and then you taught it how to translate resources from one side to the other. That's kind of where we are with some of the decentralized exchanges and atomic swaps, sidechain technology, two-way pegs, and things like that in blockchain. You have these fundamentally non-interoperable blockchains. And then in order to bridge the gap, you have to have a trusted centralized system in between that speaks both languages and translates, or if we're really good about it, maybe an atomic trustless swap. I think gradually we're going to see more of that happening. And I think gradually we're going to see big networks of these systems connect to each other with various forms of gateways. And then the next logical step is that some protocol or some features of some protocol emerge as a winner and get broadly adopted, especially in a place like open source in the blockchain space where you don't have patent problems for the most part. It's mostly open source, open APIs, open interfaces. You can emerge with open standards that allow people to build these gateways. So my vision of the future of chains is basically where it becomes easier and easier to move value and state and smart contracts from one chain to another, or at least interact with value and state and smart contracts between chains for very low cost with very little required trust in third parties, if no trust at all, if possible. And as these things become smoother and smoother, eventually some protocols emerge that allow interoperability of these networks. And these protocols become the layer three of blockchains. And in the longer term, I can see a scenario where the average user doesn't really use a blockchain. They use a wallet that is a multi-protocol wallet that can interact both with the layer one and layer two chains, the layer one chains and the layer two protocols, if you like, but also using some more standardized interoperable protocol, be able to use services to translate one token to another and jump from one chain to another, and does so without very much user interaction. So it does so almost automatically, just like your browser chooses routing protocols or communication protocols or encryption protocols without you noticing. I think that's where we're going. I don't know which protocol is going to win. I don't think anybody does. But I do think that a lot of the differences between blockchains are going to get abstracted away. Some cannot be abstracted away. Some protocols will always be better for some things. But in the long term, I don't see us really being able to get mainstream adoption among users if the user needs to understand the subtle differences between each chain and can only move from one chain to another through a centralized intermediary. I don't think that's a model that is very robust.
What kind of economic changes in tokenomics, in assets issuance design, in the ties or maybe the weakening of ties between assets and chains do you think need to take place to enable better coordination of blockchains so that instead of 10 blockchains trying to build smart contract platforms to do essentially the same thing, they find some way to coordinate and specialize and provide in the end a better gestalt experience to the users?
That's a great question. Ironically enough, one of the things that generally helps with consolidation and undoes fragmentation is economic recessions. So in economic recessions, everybody's model gets tested. And if those recessions are allowed to clear out the undergrowth and clear out the balance sheets and discard the not working models and let the failures fail, then what comes out of that is consolidation and kind of a reemergence of a new industry where things are a bit more sane and rational. And I think that's already happened in crypto a couple of times, and I think it's about to happen again. My prediction is that in 2 years, a very large percentage of the startups, blockchains, and systems that exist today will be gone. And they'll be gone because they'll run out of funding. They simply will. We're going to see a massive retrenchment in VC funding. We're going to see a massive retrenchment in other sources of capital and liquidity crunch. So a lot of the startups in the crypto space are simply going to die. And because in the crypto space, there are no bailouts and there are no committees of benevolence to choose winners, you know, this is going to be a brutal reckoning with natural selection. And the end result will be that companies that are more flexible, more adaptive, projects that are more flexible, protocols that are more flexible and more adaptive are going to win. The ones that are able to retain developers, retain users, retain activity are going to survive. And those that are not going to survive. So one of the things I think we're going to see is the pandemic and the resulting recession is going to withdraw this economic stimulus that has occurred in crypto. I don't think we're going to be recipients of government stimulus very much. And a lot of projects that do not have a future are going to face that fact and that reality.
I agree. I think that some cyclical activity of recessions and, I don't know if I would quite call it a stimulus, but reinjection of capital in cycles probably helps with consolidation. But I think it will take more too. I think it will take a change in the nature of the relationship between assets and protocols. Right now, assets and protocols are very closely tied. And this means that while the sort of technical fundamentals of blockchains aren't really in competition with each other, because the assets are in competition or perceived to be in competition with each other, lots of blockchains sort of duplicate each other's technical efforts or fail to coordinate and specialize or attach themselves to technical decisions as if they were sort of a religious fealty test instead of just looking for the best available option. I mean, blockchains are databases, right? Like, no one worries too much about a fealty to database protocols. You just use whatever suits your purposes. And eventually, I hope that we get there with blockchains as well.
I think that is true to a certain extent. I also think that some of the technical choices and design choices actually really affect the fundamental capabilities and features of the applications you can build. So while you can abstract away certain differences and say, oh, well, you know, this is yet another smart contract platform that more or less behaves like the previous one or the other one that we all know, and it doesn't differentiate enough, I think there are some differentiations on the technical level that you can't abstract away. And if anything, those will shine a bit brighter during this period because a lot of the other distractions get removed. But, you know, consolidation is going to be a big factor in fixing this issue of fragmentation. The bottom line is that if one smart contracts platform or two work well enough and already have a significant advantage in users, developers, etc., in a consolidating environment where funding becomes scarce, you know, quite honestly, the others won't survive. And it's really as simple as that. The water is going to recede enough. The only things floating are the ones that were in good deep waters. Everything else runs aground. So I think we're going to see massive consolidation in that space. And some of the projects are going to survive, not because of their market characteristics, but because the combination of their technical characteristics, market characteristics, and affinity of developers and users are going to keep them afloat.
Do you think protocols for interoperability will help consolidation, will hinder consolidation? If it's easier to move state and assets between chains, will users switch chains more rapidly, or will chains start attacking each other? How do you imagine that dynamic playing out?
That's a great question. Yeah, I would say the protocols of interoperability, and they don't have to be like interchain infrastructure. It could simply be decentralized exchanges and atomic swaps or things like that. They have an enormous effect because what they do is they keep the switching costs very, very low. And the barriers to switching in terms of time and time value of money, as well as the bureaucratic barriers to switching, are almost non-existent in this space. You can very, very quickly and effortlessly move value. Now, things are not the same in smart contracts. Smart contracts have more stickiness than pure currency. When it comes to pure currency, you know, a Bitcoin's a Bitcoin. If you change it to another unit of value, its characteristics are not going to require a complete overhaul of your infrastructure, at least, although it may change its capabilities a bit. But you can't so easily simply take a smart contracts platform that exists on one smart contracts environment and move it to another. So I think it's going to be more difficult there. But the bottom line is that these markets are among the most free markets and well-functioning markets that we've ever seen. There are so few barriers to entry. There are so few switching costs and so low switching costs that there really is very, very vibrant and vigorous competition. And interoperability through interchains or even simple things like decentralized exchanges make it very easy for that competition to effectively pick winners, right? And consolidate the marketplace.
What are the projects that you're looking at now that you see promise for the foreseeable future to be so-called selected by nature?
Well, you know, I try not to endorse specific projects. You know, people know the kinds of things that interest me. But when I say I'm interested in a project, it's primarily because I'm interested in the underlying technology. And I really don't have any insights as to whether those projects are going to make for good investments, for example. I'm interested in both smart contracts platforms like Ethereum, as well as pure monetary blockchains like Bitcoin. I'm interested a lot in layer two technology, both in Bitcoin and Ethereum and other chains, the development of side chains. I'm very interested in zero knowledge protocols and privacy related coins. And I think that as we move towards an environment with more currency wars on a geopolitical basis, as well as more aggressive surveillance and restriction of freedoms, privacy coins and zero knowledge systems are going to become increasingly important, increasingly needed, and increasingly developed as a natural reaction to basically attacks on privacy. So those are the kinds of things that I follow, but obviously my time is limited, as is everybody else's. So I don't really have much of an opinion for systems that I don't have time to study in depth. And I mostly focus on keeping my own financial affairs stable and diversified. I don't take maximalist positions because I think that's self-defeating. And keep my curiosity in technology alive and always seeking and reading and learning. So I'm not the type of maximalist who picks one project and only that. And I think there's a lot of interesting stuff happening across the board. Lately, I've been paying a lot more attention to decentralized finance, DeFi, over the past year or so. And it's been very, very interesting to watch how some of those projects are weathering these financial storms. I think we're learning a lot by observing how they operate under these very, very difficult conditions. The most recent example, of course, being the DAE MakerDAO issues that occurred during the 55% drop in Ether's price. But yet, you know, those projects are surviving. So a test that doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And it's very interesting to watch all of these projects grow. That's the best question I can give you without an endorsement.
Of course.
Thank you so much for inviting me on the show. It's really a pleasure. Stay safe, you and your family. Hope you manage the best through these difficult times. And thank you again for the opportunity.
Yeah, it was a pleasure on our end too. Thank you, Andres. And we'll see you next time on the Interchain FM.